Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is award-winning journalist Emma Maris, and we're here talking about her new book, Wild Souls, Freedom and Flourishing in the Non-Human World. Emma, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you about this book.
It's great to be here.
This is an interesting book. It's a book that questions our assumptions of certain terms like nature and wildness, and do these concepts even make sense in the modern world? A lot of people, everybody I would expect, uses terms like nature and wild, but do they ever think about what they're talking about? And that's one of the ways to start into your book. Talk to me about what you think about those two terms.
Well, I've been covering conservation as a journalist and as a writer for 15 years. And as I've gone through those years, I have spent some time thinking about what we're really talking about when we talk about nature or when we use the word wild. So in my first book, I spent a lot of time talking about what nature is and what is wilderness. And I talk about that a bit in this book as well. And in this book, I also tackle this sort of adjective wild as applied to animals, wild animals. What does that actually mean? So to put it briefly, I think that we can get very misled by thinking that the value in the non-human world is in its wildness, that it's only valuable insofar as that it's uninfluenced by people. I think that's an idea that's very prevalent in sort of Western environmental circles, but I think it's one that's sort of fundamentally mistaken and based on some bad assumptions and some bad understandings of history. There weren't really big, pristine wildernesses in North America when white people first got here, for example. Much of the land was already being very carefully managed.
By the people who lived here, Native Americans.
Yes, right.
And there's a great book on that called Changes in the Land.
That's a classic.
Yeah, and that talks about how the land was managed by Native Americans in New England.
Yeah, and there's a great, if you're on the, there's been a lot of scholarship on that I've been following with great interest. But I also think that our sort of obsession that we have about the non-human, you know, about nature being free from human touch can be counterproductive on a pragmatic level, because it means that we don't think as hard about ways in which humans and non-humans can interact positively. We always just try to get humans out of the picture, remove humans from the landscape, undo what humans have done. But I actually think in some cases, humans and non-humans can have good, productive, mutually beneficial relationships. And I get into that a little bit in the book about how that would look with animals. You know, what always makes me sad is that the sort of correct thing to do with animals is to teach them to fear humans. And that's always sort of broken my heart, because I'd like to imagine a world where humans and wild animals could coexist without us having to train animals to fear us.
Yeah, but within an urban environment, which is where I live, for instance, there was a fox that was really quite friendly and stuff like that, as foxes are. But people totally freaked out. They thought it was totally unnatural for a fox to be walking around in an urban neighborhood, and they wanted it destroyed immediately. And that was the reaction that got carried through. It disappeared after that day when people were pulling up in a car going like, why is that fox just lying there? Going like, it's just bathing. It's fine. But they had this attitude like, kill it. Some people are going to be positive in their interactions with nature. However, an awful lot of people have very negative attitudes towards the natural world.
No, absolutely. And
I should say the non-human world. I didn't mean to say the natural world. The non-human world.
I think it's definitely true that on a pragmatic basis, you know, we can't just, we can't change the way we interact with wild animals radically overnight. In the book, I talk about our kind of existing relationships as they play out in places like zoos or in conservation programs and also in wildlife management. I think that there's different directions we could go in all of those spheres, but, you know, not 180 degrees overnight, potentially.
One of the interesting things is that you apply moral philosophy, the study of ethics, to these problems. And what you're encouraging the reader to do is to examine their own values and beliefs. Now, you come to some conclusions, but you fully admit there are some things that you're not settled on and you're not sure about. But the point of the book is for all of us to start looking at what we mean when we use these terms, right? Is that a way to understand the book?
Yeah, that's beautifully summarized. And what I really hope to do in this book is to give the reader the tools that they can use to come to their own conclusions about how humans and non-humans interact and what the right way for us to deal with wild animals is.
And going forward, because it's a mess right now.
Yeah, I do share, you know, I kind of structured the book so I started with the stuff that I felt more confident about my own conclusions, like zoos. I don't think zoos as they're currently run are a good place.
When I get to that chapter, Emma, that was one of those chapters that just made me went, you know, right on. And let's back up with that. One of the things that people need to realize is that through current research, and you talk about this extensively in the book, that we realize that many, many animals are sentient, they're conscious, they have feelings, many of them have personalities, and many of them, and this your own term, live in massively complex, interspecific social worlds. And what does it mean when we realize that, when we really take that to the research to heart, that these animals are sentient and conscious, and then we look at a zoo?
Yeah, I think it's interesting to note that the sort of view of animals as basically unconscious robots just hanging out in the landscape is one that I was more or less raised with, but it's definitely not a global universal. And there's many cultures that have always seen animals as entities with their own individuality and their own agency. But having said that, zoos definitely kind of became an institution in a world where people were thinking about animals as just examples of their kind or sort of unsentient robots. But once we realized that those are simply incorrect, that animals, especially animals like mammals and some birds and, you know, that they have personalities, desires, they make choices, it becomes a lot harder to justify keeping them captive purely for entertainment purposes.
Right. Well, the argument will always be, well, you know, we're educating the public about these animals, or we're helping to breed these for reintroduction back into the, quote, wild.
Right. Yeah, and both of those are, you know, both of those are reasons that I kind of bought into for a long time. You know,
you loved going to the zoo as a kid.
Yeah, I did. And I definitely assumed that zoos were very active in conservation and that, but once I started doing the research and looking into how to quantify their contributions to conservation or whether there were actually a lot of conservation breeding programs going on in zoos, I was kind of shocked to find out it's a kind of greenwashing. There's not there is some investment, there are some conservation breeding programs, but they're vastly outnumbered by breeding programs that are simply for display.
Or to give to other zoos, to trade off to other zoos. They breed them, and then there's a lot of trade goes on between zoos.
Yes, yeah. And, I mean, what's interesting is that I think, you know, when they breed the animals, they do try very hard to keep their genetics healthy and diverse. And they always talk about this as if it's for conservation, but there's very little chance of most of these animals ever being released into the wild.
Yeah, well, that's really obvious. And the other thing is that, especially when I look at captive great apes like gorillas or chimpanzees or elephants, you're talking about very intelligent animals who, I don't care how great you make the cage, you know, and there's a big to-do about, well, we're making their environments like... It's not their real environment. And they and the animals, and by and large, the animals are not really happy where they are.
Right. I found in my research that escapes and escape attempts are pretty common, and also that medicating animals so that they will be happy, you know, that they won't be so obviously distressed in their captivity is also very common.
Like downers, like Prozac for animals.
Oh my God. And sedatives are the major classes of drugs that are prescribed, and some antipsychotics even. There are some animals who seem to be truly driven mad by captivity.
I know elephants are all the time. Yeah. And there's great examples of gorillas just finally getting fed up. And all a human has to do is fall into a cage, as they are often doing now for their own stupid reasons. And then they blame the animal. And in any event, the animal gets shot or euthanized.
One thing I want to add while we're talking about zoos is that I don't think that the people who work at zoos and who care for animals as keepers or veterinarians, that those guys are bad guys, you know, villains in this story.
They just have bought into a different paradigm, right?
Yes, that's right. And like on an individual basis, they are almost all completely motivated by their love for animals and their care for these individuals. And they are very loving people. So I really want to make that clear that people who work at zoos are not the bad guys here. I think it's just the institution itself needs to radically change, move towards a model that is much more about conservation breeding or about rescues.
You actually suggest in the book, I find this really hilarious because you're such a plant person.
That
everybody should go to botanical exhibitions to satisfy that need. You try to sell that to me. I love plants. I love plants. But go ahead, sell it to me.
Well, you know what? I think one of the reasons that zoos persist and why they're so beloved is because they're a great thing to do with a family,
right?
Or with a group of friends, or especially with kids. And so the idea of sort of either shutting them down or changing them to much more sort of scientific breeding facilities makes it seem like that would take that away as an option for what to do on a Sunday afternoon. But botanical gardens fill a really similar function. And, you know, botanical gardens in some of the bigger cities are just gorgeous, splendid places. And the one advantage of them is that you can always see the plants. You don't walk up to the enclosure and you can't find the giraffe in there anyway. They hold still. You can touch them even. You can really get up close to them. And they like a zoo, a garden shows the sort of wonderful diversity that evolution has produced.
Yep. And I think I think the problem there is education. I don't think young people, grade schoolers through high school, I don't think they're taught enough about plants and how to look at them.
I definitely agree with that. Yeah.
And how to enjoy them. I mean, how to actually just sort of look at them and be impressed by them, other than carnivorous plants.
Which are like animals in the
well, yeah, that's exactly right, and that's why like people are into carnivorous plants. I mean, I love them too, but you know. Now there's a couple of words you use that I found really interesting, and I want you to talk about. And one of them is flourishing, and why is that important to you?
So the word flourishing is how sort of English speaking philosophers usually translate a word that Aristotle used to describe sort of what's good about a human life. You know, if you really dig into the foundations of ethics, one of the central questions is, what is valuable?
Yeah.
And almost everyone, with very few exceptions, will agree that a human life is valuable. That's why murder is wrong. But it isn't just being alive that's valuable. It's really having a good life. And so Aristotle used a word for that in Greek, which is often translated as flourishing. So this means more than just, you know, having enough to eat and not being sick. The plane going over.
I heard that. That was great. Okay.
It means more than just having enough to eat or not being sick. It also means, you know, sort of pursuing your interests or living a full life, having personal relationships with others. And for many wild animals, a lot of these same things can apply. A wolf or a gorilla can flourish as well. It looks a little different than the way we flourish. But there is a difference between them just being alive and physically healthy and them having a life that they're happy with. So I do think that when I look at what does wild really mean to me, I think the way that in which it is valuable is not so much in whether or not humans have influenced the animal. It's about whether the animal gets to make its own choices. And I think that really does lead to animal flourishing.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is award-winning journalist Emma Maris. And we're talking about her new book, Wild Souls, Freedom and Flourishing in the Non-Human World. In this book, you actually do a lot of field reporting, especially from Australia and New Zealand, but also within the United States. And you talk with and actually see different schemes to reestablish creatures that have become very, very rare. In Australia, there's the bilby, for instance. In New Zealand, there's kiwi species. And in North America, there's the wolf and the condor. The condor is a great example of this. But one of the things you question is, and especially let's talk about the condor, is what are we doing? It's like the condors are all tagged now. They're all carefully monitored. They're fed. So what is it? Is it a pet?
Right, exactly. And you know, so I just talked about how it's valuable. It's good for animals to be able to make their own choices. And the condor captive breeding program was a situation where we captured every single existing condor and put it in a cage and said, we're going to take over your life for
now. There was
a
reason for that.
Because there was a reason for that.
There's so, extremely few condors. They're slow nesters to recover. They're being poisoned a lot.
Yes.
And I actually get to see the last wild condors when I think there was 18 left, and I got to see eight of them before any of this was even considered. But now we've got this strange thing. So are we working towards that eventually we won't have anything to do with them, then they can just live on their own? Or are they now permanently under our care?
Right. So in the book, I talk about this category of animals called conservation-reliant species, and by now condors are definitely on that list. They're animals who still exist in the world, but only because we are watching and helping every minute as they go. I think almost anybody involved in the condor project would tell you that, yes, that the goal is for eventually for us not to have to be involved in their lives at all, that someday, 100 years from now, they won't have numbers on their wings. They won't have to be captured to be given treatment for lead poisoning. We won't be naming them all and giving them numbers. That is the end goal.
But is that actually going to happen?
I'm a very optimistic person.
You are. You're really upbeat in this book.
So I think it may be that we won't be able to, sort of completely let go of the reins on the condors for another century. We might both be dead by the time it happens.
That's right. And I totally accept long-term solutions. And this gets to what we value. And you talk a lot about it. You write a lot about it in the book.
I talk a lot about it at home, too.
Yeah, I would be really scared to be one of your kids.
Well, their father's a philosopher, so yeah.
Oh, great.
Conversation can get pretty intense.
Oh, my God. But you write about how should we value ecosystems.
Right.
And also biodiversity. Does biodiversity have intrinsic value? And you conclude at one point, you don't know. You're not sure. You enjoy it. You know that you like it. But does it have intrinsic value? And what does that mean?
Yeah, this was the part of the research that made me personally extremely uncomfortable. Because I love biodiversity. It is, I'm not a religious person, but I am sort of, because my religion is biodiversity. So delving into the nitty-gritty of how environmental ethicists have tried to show that all the different species that evolution have produced are valuable because there are, just in and of themselves because of their diversity, that was a really interesting ride and a really tough one, because I wasn't completely convinced that if there was nobody around who loved all these species, that they would still be valuable even without us. Now, I know many of your listeners are going to be kind of shocked by that. So I encourage them to read my book before they come after me, because
then,
I definitely get into the details.
Right. And also, again, underlining what we said at the beginning, you encourage people to come to their own conclusions.
Yes, that's absolutely right.
So read the book so you have some background.
Yeah.
And then play your ideas against yours.
Right, absolutely. So what I really, I've spent a lot of my career sort of translating science for the lay public. I try to do the same thing here for environmental ethics. And I think I do a pretty decent job of making it accessible to people who didn't take any philosophy classes in their lives. So give it a shot. It's not as hard. Philosophy was very intimidating to me when I first started.
But and now I use it as a cudgel.
Yeah, well, no, it turns out that everyone can do philosophy. You can't need the toga.
That's a discussion. Emma, that's a discussion for another time. We're going to get lost in the weeds about that. I want to talk about other sections of your book. There are schemes to rescue rare species that involve the killing of other species.
Right.
Sometimes huge numbers of other species.
And this is why I went to Australia and New Zealand, because while in North America we have some conservation killing, it really is central to the practice of conservation in island systems like Australia, New Zealand, and other Pacific islands and other islands around the world.
So how are we to think about that? Well, can I put this in a more even home around home stretch? There are many people that put up bluebird boxes here.
Right.
And then what happens is house sparrows come in and nest in them, and they freely kill the house sparrows, or even the house wrens that'll do the same thing. And I always ask people, this is one reason I don't put the boxes up. I feel I can't make that moral decision. I'm comfortable with the fact that I can't make that moral decision, but nobody else thinks about it. They just automatically go, bluebird's good, house wren's bad, kill them.
Well, the reason that I was interested in this is that there are two different ethical frameworks that are sort of at odds with each other. And one is the environmental or conservation framework, which basically says it's okay to kill in order to save species. No problem. Species are the more important value.
Right, right, right.
And then there's the animal rights approach, which says you can't kill animals for any reason. You just can't, you shouldn't be doing it. So how do you reconcile? And there are so many people who are both animal lovers and lovers of biodiversity, right? They don't want to see extinctions, but they also don't want to kill. So how do you move forward with that tension? And I spend quite a few chapters in the book looking at that, because it's a very tricky question.
And I think people are making those decisions. My point about the story about the wren and the bluebirds, I think people are making those decisions in their backyard. And it also gets to another thing that you bring up, is that attitudes towards, quote, invasive species.
Yeah, so one thing that's bothered me for a long time is that we seem to have a different moral code for how we can treat non-native animals than how we can treat native animals. And some of the ways that people kill non-native species in their backyards would actually be considered animal cruelty, and potentially even could get you in trouble legally if you did it to a cat or a dog or a horse. Some people might say, well, but some belong and others don't. But we got to remember, these animals have no clue who's native and who's not native and who's the good guy and who's the bad guy. Like, this is all a human framework. They have no idea who's got the right passport. So it does seem weird that we treat them differently from a kind of a humaneness perspective.
I also worry, and maybe this is totally unfounded, that the more negative talk about invasive species, it sort of blows back to people who are immigrants.
Right.
And I know that sounds like a stretch, but I'm not so sure that it is.
No, I mean, I this is something that I talk about a lot, and I'm never totally sure how much to push it, because it is at some levels a stretch. But it is interesting to me that many of the people's political values lead them to embrace immigrants and to want to protect human immigrants. So some of the people who are the most politically kind of moved to protect immigrants or to stand up for human immigrants are the same ones who are like the most opposed to plants and animals moving from place to place or getting out of their native range. And that's always been something I found very interesting. There's a kind of a purism when it comes to non-humans that they don't have when it comes to humans moving around.
Well, again, another practical example here is cowbirds. Okay, cowbirds used to dwell in the plains. As we destroyed the forests here, they've moved east, and they parasitize the nests of other birds. And I teach bird classes, and it's funny, when people look at cowbirds, they start swearing at it and calling it evil. And I have to stop them going, the bird's not evil. It's doing its behavior. We're the ones that chop down the forest and allowed the bird to come in here. Now, Granted, you may want to remove the cowbird egg. That's up to you. But it's just amazing that they put values on behavior.
Yeah, I think that's a great example. I see that same situation playing out very frequently where an incoming species gets kind of vilified on a very personal and emotional level. And almost always the reason that they're incoming is because of some change that humans have made to the environment. So who's the bad guy here?
Come on. I know. In the end, how does global climate change figure into all of this? Is that the ultimate moral problem that we need to resolve?
I think that what climate change does is it actually makes us really test a lot of our values. Because of the way that a lot of our environmental values were shaped in this country back in the 60s and 70s were about preserving conditions as they were and making sure that things didn't change. And climate change is going to change the ecosystems around us in fundamental ways. That's just a given. It's already happening. I'm standing in my garden right now looking at plants that are blooming that shouldn't be blooming. That kind of thing. So I think, you know, that what climate change, and we've already seen in the scientific literature, people trying to differentiate climate migrants from invasive species. Because obviously, as the climate warms, species are going to be moving around. I think ultimately climate change is going to put the final kibosh. It will finally destroy the purism that I think holds back conservation. And it'll make us realize that what we have to do is try to protect the biodiversity without having to put everything back the way it looked in 1800.
With that, we're all out of time. You end the book, I love this, lovingly but insistently demanding a world in which we really take care of each other, in which we all flourish together. That was a very kumbaya moment. Thank you.
Sure. I'm always happy to provide that because
I knew you did.
That we can do this.
My guest tonight has been award-winning journalist Emma Maris, and we've been talking about her new book, Wild Souls, Freedom and Flourishing in the Non-Human World. Emma, it's been a real pleasure.
Thanks so much.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.